With religious prose, we're finally coming to a realistic understanding of what Old English literature is all about. Because as we saw in week two, poetry accounts for a mere 6% of the corpus. Poetry and glosses to either prose or poetry, mostly psalms in the latter case, account for nearly everything else, and you better believe that a large proportion of those prose works is religious in nature. So does that mean that Old English literature is mostly boring? Well, sure, if you want to take a superficial view of things. But it is my experience that most things do, in fact, become more interesting if only you look closely enough. For one thing, the primary text that you read for today, the Book of Maccabees, as translated and commented on by Elfridge, is far from boring. It is full of warfare and heroic action. But it does illustrate another point about Old English prose, and that is that a lot of it is based on Latin texts. This means that when we study the Old English texts, it is not always possible to say very much about the literary imagination, say, of the individuals who produced them, since we may have to think of them more in terms of translators than of authors. In these cases, we may be reduced to making observations about such things as the choice of texts that were adapted, the changes that were made to the original text, and also the context in which the text was transmitted. Even so, many of our texts are not straightforward translations, but until at least some degree of innovation. A very prominent group of texts is the homilies, a word, homily, that in Anglo-Saxon context means simply sermon, written for preaching, or in some cases perhaps for private study too. The homilies are a highly dynamic genre, by which I mean that many texts of this category may be seen to borrow liberally from other texts, whether it is from Latin texts or from other vernacular homilies. As a consequence, individual homilies are often a pastiche of pre-existing content and new material, collected around a common theme or around a single scriptural reading, and we can trace echoes of shared material from text to text to text. The homilies are one of the most prominent genres of Old English literature, and yet I will so say no more about them today, because Esther Lemmert will fill half a session with them on January 14th. Today, instead, I will focus on biblical translation, saints' lives, and religious historiography, and ask questions such as, what sorts of religious prose writings survive? What place did the Bible occupy in Anglo-Saxon culture? In what form was biblical content transmitted, and what parts of the Bible were translated? What motivations lie behind the fact of these translations? What role did the cult of saints play in medieval worship? And what is the history about their veneration anyway? How did that typically translate into literary form? And finally, we'll turn to the ecclesiastical history by Bede and ask, what are we to make of his account of the conversion of King Edwin of Deira? Now, here again is our list of genres from week two. As with the poetry last week, I have been able simply to copy out the slide containing all the prose and modify it to reflect religious prose only. But that has required considerably more changes in this particular case. As you see, I've struck out secular law. Not all law is secular. We have canon law, which tells you how to behave and what punishment is associated to transgressions of a moral nature. But secular laws, charters, and records, these are the legal categories that are typically not very closely associated with religious content. The same is true of many of the books of learning that survive. Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy is often read with a religious background, and it was written with a religious background, but it doesn't explicitly mention Christianity. It's the same for the works of computistics, the technical treatises of time reckoning that tell you about the phases of the moon and the tides. And although a lot of their focus is on the dating of Easter, they're still just technical reference manuals rather than religious works. And the same is true, of course, of Elfrich's Latin grammar. The historiography I have explained to you before is typically written with an interest in the spiritual interpretation of history, although you could argue that is less the case with the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. The medical texts, as you see, I've put in parentheses, because superstitions may be considered religion, so superstitious healing practices then also are religious. But there are some really odd Anglo-Saxon treatments that fall somewhere in between the realms of magic and medicine. A common metric in this context has been to say that if a treatment is at least applied to that part of the body where the problem is, we can count it medicine. If you only have to carry something around as a talisman, it's magic or religion. You may hear more about this in the first week of January. And then I've struck out all the travel literature, the Alexander literature, and the romance Apollonius of Tyre, because these are simply not Christian in origin. But most things else are. I've mentioned the homilies. I've said that there are ecclesiastical laws as well. The saints' lives are a very large category. There is biblical translation, as we'll discuss today. And then, of course, there are all the texts that are more specifically about how to live a Christian life, how to carry out Mass, and so forth. Even the dialogues, which are about wisdom, tend to focus on biblical wisdom. And it's the same for the letters and so forth. So let's have a look then. Today's lecture comes in three parts and a postscript. We'll talk about biblical prose. We'll talk about Maccabees. We'll talk about saints' lives, and we'll have a brief look at Bede's account of the conversion of Edwin of Deira. No one should discuss Anglo-Saxon biblical translation without a word of warning from our sponsor, Elfrich of Ensham, the most prolific named author of the Old English Corpus. Because as much as I hate to perpetuate a cliché about medieval culture, the notion that medieval clergymen considered themselves gatekeepers, tasked with the responsibility of keeping the unlearned away from difficult passages so that they couldn't do any damage, is unfortunately entirely true. And so Elfrich, in a preface to a translation of Genesis that he produced, writes, "Elfrich the monk humbly greets Ealdorman Ethelwerd. You have asked me, sir, to translate the book of Genesis from Latin into English for you. At the time, it seemed to me a difficult thing to grant to you, and you said then that I need to translate no more of the book than up to Isaac, son of Abraham, because someone else had translated the book for you from Isaac to the end." Okay, so far so good. "Now it seems to me, sir, that that task is very dangerous for myself or any other person to undertake, because I fear that if some foolish person reads the book, they will think that they may now live under the new law, as did the patriarchs who lived in the time prior to the establishment of the old law, or as people lived under the law of Moses." If you're confused about the timeline here, Elfrich is identifying three periods in human history. There's a time before any laws were codified or written down. Sure, there were some rules about what trees to eat from, but those weren't very important because they were broken pretty well as soon as they were set. But then there's a whole period between creation and the Exodus, in which there is no law that we can find, at least in the books of the Bible. But as soon as the people of Israel are in the desert, God gives Moses a very elaborate set of laws that he then relays to the people of Israel. So that would be the law of Moses that Elfrich refers to. From a Christian perspective, most of those laws were superseded with the coming of Christ. And so that would be the period, the third period, under the new law or the new covenant that he refers to. Okay, so then Elfrich, how does that translate into practice? Well, Elfrich says, "I once knew that a priest, who was my teacher at the time, owned the book of Genesis, and he was able to understand Latin in part. Then he said, concerning the patriarch Jacob, that he had four wives, two sisters, and their two servant girls. He was quite right, but he did not know, nor did I at the time, how big a difference there is between the old law and the new. In the beginning of this world, brothers took their sisters to wife, and sometimes fathers begot children by their own daughters, and many had several wives by which to increase the population. And it was not possible at first to marry except among one's relations. If anyone would want to live in that way now, after Christ's coming, the way people lived prior to or under the law of Moses, that person is not a Christian, nor indeed is he worthy that any Christian eat with him. So then, if it's so dangerous to read the Old Testament today, and if those laws no longer apply anyway, then why should we read the Old Testament at all? Well, Alfrich continues, when unlearned priests understand some little part of the Latin books, they immediately think that they can be famous teachers. But nevertheless, they do not know the spiritual sense of it and how the old law was a sign of things to come, or how the New Testament after Christ's incarnation was the fulfillment of all those things concerning Christ and his elect, which the Old Testament prefigured. Now, this is very important. We talked about this last week. Alfrich here acknowledges the practice of typology or allegory, by which events that are literally narrated have, on top of their literal value, also an allegorical referent, whether it is in the New Testament or in the lives of private believers. So Alfrich here acknowledges the practice of typology, and he claims that the Old Testament is a dangerous thing when read by those who are untrained in it. Now, in the light of this reluctance, it is interesting to see that, in fact, Alfrich outproduces any other Anglo-Saxon translators of biblical material by a vast margin. While this could be read as evidence that Alfrich did not always follow his own advice, perhaps the likely conclusion is that Alfrich believed that he produced responsible translations, either omitting dangerous material or explaining it so well that even those untrained in theology would not be able to misinterpret it. And indeed, we do have some evidence of both these tendencies. When Alfrich translates the book of Judges and tells how Samson visits Gaza, he conveniently omits the reason for Samson's visit, a prostitute, because we don't want Christians to think that it is still all right to visit prostitutes. And at the end of his adaptation of the books of Maccabees, which you've read for today, Alfrich makes sure to explain that we shouldn't still be running around chopping off each other's heads. One of the most notable innovations of the Christian movement is, in fact, its pacifism. So the Maccabees are a poor example there. But we'll get to all that today. When we looked at verse biblical paraphrase last week, we saw that the corpus there is really quite small. In fact, had the Junius manuscript not survived, there wouldn't have been much of a corpus to speak of. The situation is different for prose translations, prose summaries and prose paraphrases, thanks mainly to Alfrich. You will have noticed that I have grouped the surviving translations into four categories based on the traditional groupings within the Bible. We have here representatives of all five books of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. We have representatives of Joshua, Judges, Kings, Judith, Esther, and Maccabees. All of these belong to the so-called historical books of the Old Testament. Then from the wisdom books, we have Job and Psalms, and from the New Testament, there are only the Gospels. Not all of these are full, accurate translations. Genesis is, but already Exodus leaves out the final five chapters of its source, and it strays just a little further from its source overall. Leviticus and Numbers are selective translations, ranging through most of the text of the original, but skipping chapters here and there. Deuteronomy is neither especially close nor at all complete. Alfrich's adaptations of the historical books are sometimes more accurately described as retellings than translations, although sometimes they are quite close, but they focus in general on whatever aspects Alfrich considered worth mentioning. That had something to do with the fact that he was translating with an audience in mind. In fact, we tend to think of these texts not so much as translations, because they are grouped with saints' lives and homilies, and so several of them are in fact typically understood as homilies, even if they go on for ages narrating biblical content, whereas a true sermon normally limits itself to just a brief Bible passage in the beginning, the so-called pericope, which we'll mention in a few minutes. As with the poetic material, the emphasis here is clearly with the Old Testament, which is more surprising for the prose than it is for the verse. As we said last week, verse prefers narrative content and good stories as found in the Hebrew Bible. But prose is ideal for relaying the teachings of Christ and his followers. So why not translate Paul's epistle to the Romans, for instance, or the book of Acts? And with that question, we enter into dangerous territory, because who is to say that these books weren't translated but subsequently lost? So really, we had best avoid arguing from absence of evidence, and so we'll have to leave this question unanswered. Let's talk instead about the Bible's role in medieval life. Its most obvious place was in Mass. What evidence we have suggests that medieval Mass, not unlike services in many denominations today, incorporated two scriptural readings. The first of these could be either from the Old Testament, or from the Epistles, the Book of Acts, or the Apocalypse. The second one had to be from the Gospels. This was the so-called pericope that typically informed the sermon. These readings, by the way, were all in Latin. The sermon could be in Latin, but we have many specimens that survive in the vernacular. Here at the bottom half of the slide, we see a typical example of a homily's opening. The title, or rubric, Dominica Decima Septima Post Pentecostem, tells us simply that this sermon is to be read on the 17th Sunday after Pentecost, which adds up to sometime about September. Then follows the opening clause of a scriptural passage in Latin, in this case, Luke 7, verse 11, followed by the formula et reliqua, which means and so forth, making clear that the pericope for this particular Sunday has to start with Luke 7, 11, so that the homily can then discuss that passage. Following the et reliqua, we see, as we often do, a translation of the relevant passage into Old English, which, in fact, goes beyond the abbreviated Latin content, since it's understood that the priest has access to the full Latin text in another volume. And then after this translation, the sermon proper begins. So certain gospel passages were assigned for reading at certain times of year, as here we see this one is for the 17th Sunday after Pentecost. This is explained in large part by the liturgical year, which is basically the calendar of feast days, a simplification of which is still found in your calendar books, if you still have calendar books. The liturgical year divides into two parts. There is the temporale, meaning at least the movable feasts, Lent, Easter, and Pentecost, and in some definitions also including Christmas. And then there is the sanctorale, the time during which there are no major feasts, except in some definitions Christmas, but this period is mostly made up by feast days, referring to the death days of saints scattered throughout the year, because their death days are celebrated as their birthdays into the afterlife, into the eternal life. As you can imagine, different occasions called for different scriptural readings, both in the first reading and also in the second reading or pericope. Even today, every Christmas service includes a reading of Luke chapter 2, the Christmas story. During Holy Week and Easter, likewise, it was appropriate to read passages about the Passion and the Resurrection from the later chapters of the Gospels. But the first reading here was often about the binding of Isaac or the crossing of the Red Sea, because the binding of Isaac was considered an Old Testament type for the New Testament event of the crucifixion, which it foreshadowed, while the crossing of the Red Sea was thought to foreshadow the Easter tradition of baptism. During Pentecost, of course, it is and was customary to read about the divine inspiration that comes over Christ's disciples at Pentecost, narrated in the book of Acts. And at all these times, the first reading can be a passage from the prophetic books that are thought to foretell the events in question, because after all the important events of Christ's life were considered the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies. If just attending church on Sundays and feast days was not hardcore enough for you, you could partake in the divine office, a series of 8 mini-services scattered throughout the day and some of the night every day. The central element of these services was the singing of the Psalms, which don't count as prose, of course, so we won't discuss them today, and they were also in Latin. But there was some reading of other biblical and patristic material as well, especially during Matins, the longest and most diverse of these 8 offices. This could include a so-called lectio continua, or continuous reading of biblical books, meaning you'd start reading a given book during Matins on a given day, and then you'd pick up where you left off next week on the same day until you're done with the book. These 2 would have been in Latin, though. The other offices included briefer biblical excerpts that we call capitula. So where else in Anglo-Saxon life did the Bible have a role to fulfill? Well, there is law. In order to understand the connection between Scripture and law, you have to remember what the first 5 books of the Old Testament are about. They may begin with creation and the fall, and then there's an enslavement in Egypt, followed by an exodus, but as soon as the Israelites are in the desert, God provides them with a law. Christians consider part of this law valid unto this day, that is, the 10 Commandments, and there's a lot more of it there in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers. That's all dismissed by Christians as having been superseded by the new covenant. But even so, in the Christian understanding of the universe, that first law code was written by God and is contained in these books of the Bible. And so, to write a new law code with any authority, one must build on the authority of that first law. So that's what King Alfred did sometime in the 880s. His law code begins, Druchten was sprekende das Wort to Moise, and thus quath, ich eum druchten thing God, ich the utjelade of Egyptalonde, and of Hera Theodome. Ne luvathu odre fremde godas over me. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, I am the Lord your God. I led you from the land of the Egyptians and out of their servitude. Do not love other foreign gods before me. And some of you may recognize that last sentence as, in fact, the first of the 10 Commandments, which Alfred then goes on to list. And in fact, he quotes a considerable part of this section of the book of Exodus there. And then he goes on and says, after it happened that many nations received the faith of Christ, many synods of bishops and other pious wise men were called throughout the world and also among the English after they received the faith of Christ. On account of the mercy that Christ taught, they then determined that secular lords would thenceforth, with their permission and without sin, be able to collect a fine, which they also determined for most crimes. So Alfred claims that there is some sort of a ecclesiastical authority that determined that secular kings, secular rulers, could in fact exact punishment from criminals. He then goes on and finally says, then I, King Alfred, gathered these laws together and ordered them to be written down, many of those which our forefathers held, which pleased me, and many of those that did not please me, I threw out by the advice of my council and instructed to be held in a different manner. So Alfred's law code survives in Old English as well as in Latin. We've seen that the Bible texts used in church and at the divine office were also in Latin. So let's maybe talk Latin Bibles for a moment. Richard Marston, the most prominent scholar of the text of the Bible in Anglo-Saxon England, counts 90 Latin Bible manuscripts that survive from the Anglo-Saxon period. 73 of these, that's more than 80%, are gospel material. Because when he says biblical manuscripts, you should not envision these as 90 complete Bibles. The books of the Bible very rarely travel together as a complete set. To make them all fit in a single volume today, we print on tiny, really thin telephone directory paper. It was really hard to make that all fit into a single parchment volume at the time. And if you could, the size of the volume would make it useless for many practical purposes. Because many of these books did, in fact, have practical applications. They were read in the divine office. They were excerpted in Mass. Pilgrims wanted books to carry with them on their way to Rome or Jerusalem. And if your monastery's Bible is spread out across 20 volumes, well then, you can have 20 monks read the Bible all at once. But the Gospels were considered especially valuable, and so they were typically exquisitely produced and traveled in a volume of their own, inlaid with lavish decorations, sometimes for display rather than to be read. In the consequence of all this, the typical medieval Bible was a part Bible, meaning either an individual book or some grouping of a couple of books, such as the Pentateuch, the Gospels, or just a couple of the prophets. The other major type of biblical manuscript was the liturgical volume, a book containing only those passages from the Bible needed in Mass or in the divine office. A manuscript of this nature to be used in Mass is called a missal. A manuscript for use in the office is called a breviary. Some complete Bibles do survive, though. There are four from Anglo-Saxon England plus fragments from a further two, but that does make them very rare. So if we have evidence of 90, or I think 89, according to this slide, Latin biblical volumes, how much was there in Old English? Well, let's consider the Gospels. We have seven copies of the so-called West Saxon Gospels, plus one full gloss of the Gospels integrally, those are the Lindisfarne Gospels, and one just of Matthew in the Rusworth Gospels. So those are nine volumes altogether, against 73 Latin Gospel volumes. The vernacular Bibles were not used in Mass. It has been proposed that they served to learn to help monks learn Latin. Now, those are all surviving manuscripts. There will, of course, have been many more. Marston estimates that there would have been 300 Gospel books, somewhere between 600 and 1,000 other part Bibles, and 40 to 50 complete Bibles in the period up to 850, so in the first 250 years of Anglo-Saxon Christianity. Between 850 and 1066, there would have been at least as many as that. Vernacular Bibles, however, never surpassed an auxiliary status during the Anglo-Saxon period. The books of Maccabees are two deuterocanonical books of the Old Testament. Like others, such as the books of Wisdom, Sirach, and Judith, they are not considered canonical by Protestant denominations, but they are at least included in the Catholic Bible and thus lend some degree of credence there. When a book is considered deuterocanonical, this is often because it doesn't quite have that Bible feel, and so accordingly, they're often the most exciting books to read. The books cover a period in the 2nd century BCE during which a Jewish faction revolted against religious persecution. The context is the following. Alexander the Great had brought much of the Middle East under his rule in the 4th century and had begun a process of Hellenization. That means the assimilation of subjected peoples to Greek culture. This affected Judea too. Certain influential Jews gave up Judaism and adopted Greek ways. After the year 200, before Common Era, Judea fell to the Seleucid Empire, which, after 175, was ruled by Antiochus IV. And about the same time, there seems to have been civil war among Hellenized Jews, the Sadducees, and traditionalist Jews, the Pharisees. Antiochus responded by sending in troops and practicing a violent form of Hellenization, involving religious persecutions and a raid on the temple. Some Jews responded by fleeing to the mountains and leading a revolt from there. Their leader was Judah Maccabeus, Maccabeus meaning the hammer. The books of Maccabees were written in the later 2nd century BCE. The first book of Maccabees tells a story of their revolt from a neutrally Judaic perspective, while the second book of Maccabees retells part of that same story already told in the first book, but it adds Pharisaic overtones, which in this context means, notably, that it claims that Judah Maccabeus believed in the resurrection of the dead. And this, of course, helped make the books agreeable to a Christian audience. Elfrich tells the story as follows, and he remains pretty faithful to his biblical source. He says, the second book tells us that certain Maccabees took spoil and wickedly hid it in their bosoms of the devilish offerings against God's law. And they all fell there that hid the spoil, slain in the battle. I should mention, this is Skeet's translation because I didn't have the time to produce one myself. This means that sometimes we get slightly old-fashioned words, and also I don't always agree with all these commas that he puts in, or his phrasing can be a little awkward. But that as an aside. And their comrades found the spoil in their bosoms and said that God himself manifested their sin and praised God's doom, his judgment, who discovered their secrets. Judas, I should mention this too, is Judah Maccabeus. He's also called Judas Maccabeus. They're interchangeable. Judas then gathered a good deal of spoil and sent to Jerusalem to offer for their sins for the release of the souls of them that were there slain, understanding religiously concerning the resurrection of us all, accepting he believed that they, after long delay, would arise from death, they who there were slain, otherwise he offered in vain his offering. But he verily considered that they that with true religion in death shall decease, that they with the Lord shall have the happiest gift into true life. You see what I mean about the phrasing being awkward. It is a holy thought and religious to pray for those who are departed, that they may be released from sins. So once again, this all doesn't sound very unfamiliar, doesn't sound all that unfamiliar to a Catholic audience. Now, let's be honest, though. Much of Old Testament history has very little bearing on Anglo-Saxon England. These are all events that take place 1,000 years and miles away. But as we saw in our introduction, Elfridge strongly believed in the allegorical or typological relevance of these narratives. He specifically mentions the law of Moses and how it foreshadows things to come in the New Testament. And so he would find occasion to draw such parallels. In his treatment of Maccabees, he does just that. The second book of Maccabees has a religious persecution story in which an old man called Eleazar is force-fed unclean meat. Now, the concept of unclean meat is much less of a thing in Christian tradition. The introduction of Christianity to Northern Europe did entail a ban on the consumption of horse meat for some reason. The Icelanders, accordingly, had to give up on this custom in the early years of the 11th century. But this wasn't an issue that was widely brought up. So when the second book of Maccabees refers to the Judaic diet laws, Elfridge has a duty both to explain to his audience what these laws were and also what divine purpose they serve. And so this is the text as it's found in Leviticus. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Say to the children of Israel, these are the animals which you are to eat, of all the living things of the earth. Whatsoever hath the hoof divided..." Yeah, this again, this is a translation, the Douay Rheims translation. I use that because it follows the Latin, but it too is, it's a little archaic, right? "Whatsoever hath the hoof divided and cheweth the cud among the beasts, you shall eat. But whatsoever cheweth indeed the cud and hath a hoof, but divided not as the camel and others, that you shall not eat, but shall reckon it among the unclean." Okay, so in other words, any animal with split hoofs and that ruminate are okay for eating, right? But both criteria have to be met. Otherwise, no eating. So this is what Elfridge does with the passage. He says, "Those beasts are clean that cleave their claws and chew their cud. They betoken the believers in God's congregation, who, with belief, receive the Old Testament and Christ's ordinance, that is, the Old Law and the New Testament, and chew God's commands ever with meditation." And so clean, or spiritually acceptable, are those who recognize the distinction between the Old Law and the New, and who earnestly contemplate God's precepts. Not only has Elfridge thus given meaning to this law that is otherwise meaningless to Christians, he has even managed to insert a reading that makes explicit the fact that the dietary laws do not apply to Christians who split the hooves or distinguish between the Old Covenant and the New. Elfridge also takes position on the Jews. After all, the books of Maccabees are entirely on Jewish history and religion, and so he feels compelled to clarify their status to his audience. So he inserts this bit. "The Jews were the dearest to God in the Old Law because they alone honored the Almighty God with worship continually. Until Christ, God's Son, was himself conceived of human nature, of the Jewish kin, of Mary the maiden, without human father. Then would not some of them believe that he was very God, but laid snares for his life, even as he himself permitted? There were, however, many good men of that nation, both in the old law and eke in the new, patriarchs and prophets and holy apostles, and many thousands that follow Christ, although some remain froward until now. They shall, however, all finally believe, but there shall perish too many in the period between for their hard-heartedness against the heavenly Savior. In other words, Elfrich feels a need to clarify that the Jews were the good guys until they became the bad guys, but even so, they may yet convert and be on the right side of history once again. Only if they don't, they'll burn in hell. There's no prompting for this interpolation in the original, other than the fact that in the story, angels have just come down from heaven on horseback to aid the Jews in battle. And that, too, might need a little explanation. Because this is the sort of passage that gives the books of Maccabees that deuterocanonical feel. Alfred writes, "It saith in the second book of Maccabees thus, that Timotheus, who before fled at the ford from Judas, that he again gathered a second army to him, and wished with weapons to subdue the Jews, and came then with an army ready to fight. And Maccabees the bold cried to God, and his fellows also, praying for help. They went then from the city, emboldened by God, and they fought together firmly with weapons. Lo, then wonderfully came five angels from heaven, riding on horses with golden apparel, and twain of the angels on both sides of Judas were fighting, and eke defended him. And they all five fought on the side of Judas, shooting their arrows and fiery lightnings on the heathen people, till they, lying down, died, 20,000 men and 600 horsemen slain." And there's a second passage in the same book that's similar. Heliodorus then intended to take the treasures, but there was seen a manifest wonder of God, so that his comrades fell down without strength and overcome with fright, suddenly through God's power. And there came riding a terrible rider, and with him journeyed two shining angels with wonderful appearance, as he was himself adorned. And the heavenly horse that the archangel sat on soon threw down the venturous Heliodorus, and the two angels tartly beat him, standing on both sides of him till he lay still, without hope of his life. He, who before, with threatening and with much splendor, pressed into the temple. Okay, so how does Elfrich deal with this? He says, "If anyone now should wonder how it might happen that angels should ride on appareled horses, then let him know soothly that everywhere say to us the holy books of God, that may not be false, that angels oft came certainly to men as riding upon horses, even as we have here related." I have to say no other passages come to mind, but perhaps I haven't read my Bible closely enough. Elfrich has more explaining to do when we come to the elephant army. First, he translates, fairly accurately, "Eupator, Antiochus' son, gathered his army far and near, and sent 100,000 of marching men, and 20,000 of mounted men, and 30 elephants, all tamed and trained to war with wonderful craft. 500 mounted men went with each elephant, and on each elephant was a warhouse built, and in each warhouse were 30 men, fighting with craft and going with eagerness." Okay, now, there's no elephants in England, so Elfrich has to explain this, right? To some men, it will seem strange to hear this, because that elephants have never come to England. And he explains, "An elephant is an immense beast, greater than a house, all surrounded with bones within the skin, except at the navel. And he never lies down. 24 months goeth the mother with foal, and 300 years they live, if they be not crippled. And man may tame them wonderfully for battle. The whale is of all fishes greatest, and the elephant is of all beasts greatest. But nevertheless, man's skill may tame them. The heathen then went to battle swiftly, and with mulberries emboldened the elephants, because mulberries are to them the pleasantest of food." Okay, now the resolution of this particular narrative. There was a very terrible army of heathen men. But nevertheless, Judas went against them with war and slew there soon 600 men. And one of his comrades, Eleazar, he hight, ran to an elephant that was the most excellent there, weaned that the king was in the warhouse that he bare. He ran with drawn sword through the midst of the band and slew ever on both sides, so that they fell dying, until he came to the elephant, and went under him, pricked him then at the navel, so that they both lay there, each one the other's slayer. Pretty cool, right? So this really is like a scene from Hollywood, right? We have a warrior who sort of rushes forward, slashing on both sides, and then when he comes to below the elephant, he sticks up his sword, and the elephant dies, but of course he dies on top of him, and so they're both dead. Now, this may remind you of a variety of different parallels in other literature. For one thing, there is, of course, a tradition of dragons being slain in Germanic literature. For instance, here in the Faulknismal, the Eddic poem, in the prose introduction, we are told, Seder and Rein went up unto Knidaheder and discovered Faulknir's tracks, that's the tracks of the dragon, from when he would slither to the water. Seder dug great pits there along the way and hid in them. But when Faulknir slithered down from his gold, he blew poison, and it landed on Seyther's head. But when Faulknir slithered across the pits, Seyther stabbed him to the heart with his sword. Now, you may have been reminded more strongly even of another dragon that from Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, right? Because we have the story here of an elephant that is protected by bone on all sides except at the navel. And so you have to go underneath and stab upwards in order to kill that elephant. Now, Tolkien probably combined the Germanic material of the dragon, which, as you can see here, is also contained in a condensed form in Beowulf, with this material from the Book of Maccabees, which he was also familiar with. In fact, I can prove that he was familiar with it because there is another Tolkienian echo of this passage. I don't know if anyone noticed. But there's a passage in the Lord of the Rings in which Sam speaks. I'm not sure what accent Sam's supposed to have, so I'm not sure I can do it. But he says, in the old days, hobbits used to go on their travels now and again. Not that many ever came back, and not that all they said was believed. News from Bree, and not sure a shire talk, as the sayings go. But I've heard tales of the big folk down away in the Sunlands, Swertings we call them in our tales, and they ride on Olifants, 'tis said, when they fight. They put houses and towers on the Olifants' backs and all, and the Olifants throw rocks and trees at one another. So when you said, men out of the south all in red and gold, I said, were there any Olifants? For if there was, I was going to take a look, risk or no. But now I don't suppose I'll ever see an Olifant. Maybe there ain't no such beast. Now, the books of Maccabees are pretty hawkish. They tell a story of partisan warfare, a band of rebels engaging with a powerful enemy. It's all very Old Testament. Elfrich, of course, does not want to give his audience the idea that Christianity is a martial religion. Quite the contrary, it is profoundly pacifist. And so, after all this bloodshed, Elfrich looks for yet another way of reinterpreting his material through the lens of typology. Writing of Judah Maccabeus, he says, in those days he was permitted to defeat his enemies, and especially the heathen that were angry against him. And he was God's thane that most often fought against their conquerors in defense of their people. But Christ, at his coming, taught us another thing, and bade us hold peace and truthfulness ever. And we ought to strive against the cruel enemies, that is, the invisible ones, and the deceitful devils that wish to slay our souls with vices. Against them we should fight with ghostly weapons. He means spiritual weapons. The ancient people of God had to fight then with weapons, and their contest had the signification of holy men who drive away vices and devils from them in the New Testament. So Elfrich thus takes all martial narrative and asserts firstly that warfare was permitted back then in Old Testament times that is no longer acceptable now. But he also reinterprets the story allegorically. The battles of the Maccabees represent the war on vice carried out in the New Testament, while tropologically, they represent an ongoing struggle against sin in the individual believer. But Anglo-Saxon England wasn't free from warfare either, and so this has to be addressed. Fortunately, late antique writers had provided a framework for so doing, still well known among lawyers today as just war theory. As Elfridge summarizes it, "Nevertheless, teachers say that there are four kinds of war. Justum, that is just, injustum, that is unjust, civile, between citizens, plusquam civile, between relatives. Justum bellum is just war against the cruel seamen, or against other peoples that wish to destroy our land. Unjust war is that which comes of anger. The third war, which comes of contention between citizens, is very dangerous. And the fourth war, that is between friends, is very miserable and endless sorrow." When the translator here says seamen, you should understand he's talking about Vikings. So Elfrid is here providing a justification for defending one's own homeland. Medieval and modern forms of just war theory build, first of all, on Cicero, who wrote extensively on the issue in terms that still match our understanding of common sense. He wrote, "The first office of justice is to keep one man from doing harm to another, unless provoked by wrong." And elsewhere he says, "Those wars are unjust that are undertaken without cause." Also he says, "The only excuse for going to war is that we may live in peace unharmed, and when the victory is won, we should spare those who have not been bloodthirsty and barbarous in their warfare." Right? All of this still makes a lot of sense. He could have been a representative of the United Nations. Now, the next bit is interesting because he tells us what he thinks punishment is for. He says, "There's a limit to retribution and to punishment. Or rather, I am inclined to think, it is sufficient that the aggressor should be brought to repent of his wrongdoing in order that he may not repeat the offense and that others may be deterred from doing wrong." So Cicero identifies deterrence as the objective of punishment. The offender should be deterred from repeating her offense, while others should be deterred by her example. Later thinkers have often adduced additional objectives for punishment. There is restoration, that is to compensate the wronged party using normally the financial means of the offender. There is incapacitation, putting someone away so as to make it physically impossible for them to repeat their offense. Rehabilitation, to reform the offender's character, and retribution, more of an abstract conviction that the offender should suffer for having to at least tried to inflict suffering on others. But in the early church, Augustine mostly followed Cicero, writing, "Peace should be the object of your desire. War should be waged only as a necessity, and waged only that God may by it deliver men from the necessity and preserve them in peace. For peace is not sought in order to the kindling of war, but war is waged in order that peace may be obtained." That particular sentence is often repeated today by people going to war. "Therefore, even in waging war, cherish the spirit of a peacemaker, that by conquering those whom you attack, you may lead them back to the advantages of peace. For our Lord says, 'Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God.'" Above all, though, Augustine emphasizes that even a just war is an unfortunate thing to happen. He says, "It is the wrongdoing of the opposing party which compels the wise man to wage just wars. But let everyone then acknowledge that this, being the fact that you're forced to go into war, is misery." At the same time, he does attribute every victory, whether by righteous or unrighteous nations, to God, who by this victory humbles the conquered, either to punish them or to remove their sins by teaching them a lesson, as it says here in the second quotation on this slide. Elsewhere, he claims that the punishment of the wicked functions as a lesson to the virtuous. It demonstrates God's justice. But Augustine's overarching tone is one that discourages strife altogether. He writes, "Your wishes are bad when you desire that one whom you hate or fear should be in such a condition that you can conquer him." Though Augustine was influential on Anglo-Saxon thought, Elfrich, in his account of just war theory, leans rather on Isidore of Seville, who in the 7th century took Cicero's ideas and subjected them to the sort of rigorous categorization so typical of Isidore's work. So these are the four categories then that Elfrich talks about, right? Just, unjust, civil, and more than civil war. And that's how we get to these four categories. So warfare then is sometimes necessary. But not everyone should be drafted into war. Appended to Elfrich's translation of Maccabees is a text on the so-called three estates. Elfrich, if this still is Elfrich writing, takes the foregoing as an occasion to explain the makeup of society. According to widespread medieval thought, society was divinely ordered into three parts: the oratores, or those who pray, bellatores, those who fight, and laboratores, or those who work. Or, as Elfrich puts it, "It is, however, to wit, that in this world there are three orders, set in unity. These are laborers, beadsmen, soldiers. Laborers are they who obtain with toil our subsistence, beadsmen are they who intercede with God for us, soldiers are they who protect our towns and defend our soil against an invading army." Elfrich goes on to express concern that monks might be drafted into defending the homeland, which after all might affect himself and his immediate colleagues. In defense of his objection that monks should not fight, he cites not just the divine order of society, but also he alleges that the monks, tasked after all with defending the nation against spiritual enemies, have it harder than the soldiers and should not be distracted from their duties. Because just as politicians today are often blamed for a financial situation over which they have limited influence, so monks also were thought spiritually responsible for any evils befalling the nation. Along with homilies and biblical translation, saints' lives are a third very prominent genre of religious literature. Saints' lives have been described as religious fan fiction. They take a holy individual and emphasize their holy deeds in both natural and supernatural terms. So let's briefly investigate the history of the concept in Christian circles. We should perhaps begin by recognizing that the concept of holiness can be used in more than one way. In the New Testament, St. Paul commonly addresses the people to whom he writes his letters and refers to them as saints, a practice we may say is concerned with relative holiness. But over time, Christianity came to recognize individuals as holy in an absolute sense, which typically requires more or less objective criteria, such as martyrdom or the performance of miracles. The Christian cult of saints was catalyzed, you could say instigated, by a series of persecutions. There was some sentiment against Christians quite generally early on, but it wasn't until 64 of our era, following the Great Fire of Rome, that Emperor Nero put a number of Christians to death. Perhaps, at least that's what Tacitus suggests, because he needed scapegoats to blame for the Great Fire. There is no evidence of explicit anti-Christian policies on the federal level for a good while after Nero. After about 200 CE, there were periodic regional discriminatory policies, but the emperors themselves did not start to draft such policies until the year 250, when Decius decreed that everyone should worship the Roman gods. If you failed to obtain certification of having done so, you could be imprisoned, tortured, even executed. His successor Valerian specifically decreed that all Christian clergy partake in pagan sacrifices, and he had some high-ranking churchmen killed. A similar decree was issued again by Diocletian in 303. But Constantine put an end to anti-Christian practices in 313 when he restored full citizens' rights to all Christians. Now, you may have noticed when acquaintances or celebrities pass away, death makes people go a lot less hard on them. Death for a cause is more powerful still and ends up giving that cause a huge boost in popularity. That's why if you have a political opponent, the worst thing that can happen to you politically is for them to be assassinated. In fact, some 14 years ago, a rookie Dutch politician running for office with an entirely new political party made up of non-politicians was assassinated at a time when it was too late for his name to be struck off the ballot. And so the elections went ahead with his name on the ballot. Now, insanely, many people ended up voting for him as a way of paying him his last respects, which is just about the least rational thing you can do, because a leaderless troop of non-politicians cannot govern a country. But that is the sort of thing that a death for a cause will affect. As for religions, religions thrive on martyrdom. Christianity is built on the martyrdom of its founder. Had Jesus not been killed, we would probably never have heard of him. It is hard to imagine what European history would have looked like without Christendom. So here then is how Christians responded to the persecutions. Firstly, to honor those killed for their faith, records of their judicial processes, so-called acta, were collected as early as the 2nd century. Veneration already happened by that time as well, in the form of honorary burials and the celebration of the dying days of saints as birthdays into the afterlife. People would gather often at the sepulchres of the dead on the anniversary of their martyrdom. Fuller accounts of the martyrs' suffering and death were then produced. These were known as passiones, and they were often elaborations of the earlier acta. They came to emphasize a concept known as imitatio Christi, the imitation of Christ, that is, parallels between the life and sufferings of Christ and those of the martyrs. As these accounts became more elaborate, oppression, suffering, and saintly powers came to be exaggerated. Lists of martyrs that were commemorated annually are attested by the mid-4th century and were gradually also incorporated into the liturgy, making the cult of saints an integral part of Christian worship. When Constantine ended the persecutions with his Edict of Milan in 313, few new martyrs were added, but the existing ones were still venerated. In addition, the literature now began to extol the virtuous living of ascetics. These ascetics, as a consequence, became a target of religious tourism, individuals seeking aid at their sites, sometimes even after their death. These sites and the remains of the saints, their bodily remains, provided a portal between the living and the dead, and the deceased saints themselves came to assume the role of intercessor. Canonization of saints was initially an organic grassroots process. In places where it did entail an official approval at all, from the 6th through the 10th centuries, this was done by the local bishop. If approved, the remains were then transferred to a prominent church in an elaborate procession known as translation, which was given so much weight that sometimes the anniversaries of these processions themselves came to be celebrated every year. The centralized canonization process was not instituted until the 13th century, the year 1234, and an investigative procedure to verify the veracity of miracles was in place by the 14th century. And that, in that respect, is where we still are. The veneration of deceased saints soon meant that powers were ascribed to their remains as well. And so began the cult of relics. Bodily remains are themselves referred to as primary relics. Any objects owned or touched by the saints during their lifetime are secondary relics, and sometimes objects that have touched other relics are known as tertiary relics. Relics were stored in reliquaries, of which we see three examples here. The pendant on the left, which is supposed to have belonged to Charlemagne, has a glass core, as you can see. And if you look closely, you will recognize a tiny wooden cross inside. The wood of this cross is claimed to have been salvaged from the original cross on which Christ was crucified. Now, I know if you were to collect all the supposed pieces of the original cross, you could probably build 9 life-size crosses, but relics like this were considered powerful talismans in the Middle Ages. When not made of glass, reliquaries were often shaped to reveal what type of relic they contained. That's why we have a whole forest of these arm reliquaries containing bones of the arm. But it was not just personal jewelry items that made use of glass. Many reliquaries were designed as standalone display cases. Such a reliquary is called a monstrance or monstrance reliquary, of which we have a typical example on the right here. Now, accounts of saints' lives and their death became ever more elaborate, and their aims grew to include not just commemoration, but also advertising, because local saints' lives were written in hopes of canonizing a local saint and bringing both church funding and religious tourism to the saint's tomb. Sulpicius Severus wrote a life of St. Martin in the closing years of the 4th century, when Martin was still alive. And this text came to be regarded as a model for saints' lives, many of which share several of the following elements. As a child, as an infant, saints were often very holy. They would, for instance, be able to instantly talk, or they were just very obedient. They obviously led a holy life, which also already may be equated with imitatio Christi, because anything, any holiness, of course, is an echo of Christ. So they would obviously be humble. They would show great charity. In some cases, they would show mortification of the flesh, for instance, by fasting. And from the 13th century onwards, there's also the ideal of poverty. Whenever they were offered an episcopacy or another high function, such as an abbothood, they would initially refuse, or at least pretend to. In some texts, we find that saints are persecuted either by the world or by actual demons. And finally, there are miracles which were sometimes carried out during their lifetime, but crucially for canonization, they have to happen also after their death, because that is evidence of their intercession with Christ on our behalf. As I mentioned, the life of Saint Martin was considered the template for a saint's life in the Latin West. Now, Martinmas is the 11th of November. That's several weeks gone now. Since we have Saint Nicholas Day coming up, though, let's have a look at his story for examples of all these features. The text, or part of it at least, survive also in Old English. And then after this first slide, the quotations are from Caxton's 15th century translation of the Latin Vita. The Old English text then says, Els wa hegi boren werth, and het sukinde was on his molar breoste, tha was hegi wunne elche wotnes daie, and elche fri daie, that he nolde sukan botan ane on daie, and belaf thonum swa forth to dam odrum daie. Sothliche bethisum godes taken was ateowod, who mare man he wooden shoulder. As soon as he was born and was suckling on his mother's breast, it was his habit that every Wednesday and every Friday he would only feed once a day. Fasting, right? And he would leave the rest until the other days. Truly, by this miracle of God, he showed what a glorious man he would become. So this is the motif of the miracle child. He's already showing his holy life and the mortification of the flesh, of which fasting is, you know, the most common example. And when his father and mother were departed out of this life, he began to think how he might distribute his riches, and not to the praising of the world, but to the honor and glory of God. And it was so that one, his neighbor, had then 3 daughters, virgins, and he was a nobleman. But for the poverty of them together, they were constrained and in very purpose to abandon them to the sin of lechery, so that by the gain and winning of their infamy, they might be sustained. Let me translate Caxton's shy 15th century English and say, this nobleman was so poor that he could not marry off his daughters because he didn't have dowries for them. And so he was thinking of prostituting them out. And when the holy man Nicholas knew hereof, he had great horror of this villainy, and threw by night secretly into the house of the man a mass of gold wrapped in a cloth. And when the man arose in the morning, he found this mass of gold, and rendered to God therefore great thankings, and therewith he married his oldest daughter, married her off, that is, of course. And a little while after this holy servant of God threw in another mass of gold, which the man found and thanked God, and purposed for to wake, for to know him that so had aided him in his poverty. And after a few days, Nicholas doubled the mass of gold and cast it into the house of this man. He awoke by the sound of the gold and followed Nicholas, which fled from him, and he said to him, Sir, flee not away, so but that I may see and know thee. Then he ran after him more hastily and knew that it was Nicholas. And anon he kneeled down and would have kissed his feet, but the holy man would not, but required him not to tell nor discover this thing as long as he lived, which he seems to have failed at because we found out, right? But clearly this story then tells of Nicholas's charity. The fact that he doesn't want to be known as the charitable donor shows his humility. And in all of this, of course, we can also read an Imitatio Christi, because Christ too gave to the poor. I'll spare you the whole story of how he came to become a bishop, but I'll read you the climax. Then the bishop said to him, Nicholas, servant and friend of God, for your holiness you shall be bishop of this place. And sith they brought him to the church, howbeit that he refused it strongly, yet they set him in the chair. So, in other words, he's been made bishop, but he really doesn't want to, and they basically just put him down there, right? So again, this is humility and the motif of the initial refusal of office. So what then about these miracles? I'll give you one of each, one lifetime miracle and one post-mortem miracle. On a day, as a ship with mariners were in perishing on the sea, they prayed and required devoutly Nicholas, servant of God, saying, If those things that we have heard of thee said be true, prove them now. And anon a man appeared in his likeness and said, Lo, see ye me not, ye called me. And then he began to help them in their exploit of the sea, and anon the tempest ceased. Now, during this time, Nicholas is actually at a synod. So he's alive, but he's elsewhere. But spiritually, he travels to them to help them out. And then I'll give you one example of a miracle after death, which is, and when he was buried in a tomb of marble, a fountain of oil sprang out from the head unto his feet. And unto this day, holy oil issueth out of his body, which is much available to the health of sicknesses of many men. Now, as I've explained in sessions past, historiography in Anglo-Saxon England was not an objective enterprise exactly. History was written from the perspective of the church and with a view to identifying God's hand in the events of the era. So before I let you go, I'd like to study one particularly worthwhile episode in Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People, remarkable not just for its partisan religious perspective, but also for its literary qualities. The story of King Edwin of Deira is as follows. Prior to his kingship, he lives in exile because then-King Adalfrith of Northumbria wants him dead because he is a rival and poses a threat to his kingship. By the year 616, Edwin is in the neighboring kingdom of East Anglia under the protection of its king, Redwald, who, by the way, is that man who we think may have been buried in the Sutton Hoo ship burial. Bede claims that Adalfrith, the king of Northumbria, the bad guy in the story, has bribed Redwald, the king of East Anglia, into killing Edwin. And Edwin is told about this by a friend, but he refuses to flee because he does not want to be the one to break the agreement with his host, Redwald, because Redwald hasn't done anything to him yet. But before Redwald follows up on his promise of treason, Edwin receives a vision in which a man tells him that he can be rescued from his plight on the condition that he faithfully follow the teachings of whoever rescues him. Edwin then agrees unconditionally, and Redwald ends up changing his mind about betraying his guests, and so he continues to honor his agreement to protect Edwin. Edwin's savior, of course, is Christ. In the same year, 616, Edwin is made king of Deira, which is part of Northumbria, and so now Edwin, as the king of Deira, is bound by his pledge to accept Christianity. But still he feels he ought to consult with his council first. And that is where we pick up. So this is then what Bede tells us about this. The king, hearing these words, answered that he was both willing and bound to receive the faith which Paulinus taught, but that he would confer about it with his chief friends and counselors to the end that if they also were of his opinion, they might altogether be consecrated to Christ in the font of life. Paulinus consenting, the king did as he said, for holding a council with the wise men, he asked everyone in particular what he thought of this doctrine hitherto unknown to them, and a new worship of God that was preached. Okay, that sets up the frame narrative. Now we're going to look at two accounts of these counselors who advise him. The chief of his own priests, Coifi, so this is then the high priest of the pagan tradition in this kingdom, immediately answered him, "O king, consider what this is which is now preached to us. For I verily declare to you what I have learned beyond doubt, that the religion which we have hitherto professed has no virtue in it and no profit. For none of your people has applied himself more diligently to the worship of our gods than I. And yet there are many who receive greater favors from you and are more preferred than I, and are more prosperous in all that they undertake to do or to get. Now, if the gods were good for anything, they would rather forward me, who have been careful to serve them with greater zeal. It remains, therefore, that if, upon examination, you find those new doctrines, which are now preached to us, better and more efficacious, we hasten to receive them without any delay." I don't know whether Bede had a source for the character and story of Coifi, the high priest, or whether he simply invented him, but it isn't hard to see that this character of a pagan high priest who is not just willing, but in fact impatient to abandon the faith which he himself represents, because he has come to the conclusion that it is good for nothing, is a mighty convenient element for Bede to use in his account of the triumph of Christianity. The description of this council is in fact followed by an amusing account of the high priest himself breaking every rule of his own religion by mounting a horse, taking up a spear in order to ride down and destroy his own temple. Especially amusing is the fact that Coifi himself here says that the gods are no good at making the king favor him more, as though the king himself weren't the weakest link in that causal chain. Unfortunately, no account survives of Coifi dying a bitter old man because the king behaved no better towards him following the conversion. But it is the passage that follows after Coifi's speech, still within the context of the council, that is perhaps the more remarkable. "Another of the king's chief men, approving of his wise words and exhortations, added thereafter, 'The present life of man upon earth, O king, seems to me, in comparison with that time which is unknown to us, like to the swift flight of a sparrow through the house wherein you sit at supper in winter, with your elder men and thanes, while the fire blazes in the midst and the hall is warmed, but the wintry storms of rain or snow are raging abroad. The sparrow, flying in at one door and immediately out at another, whilst he is within, is safe from the wintry tempest. But after a short space of fair weather, he immediately vanishes out of your sight, passing from winter into winter again. So this life of man appears for a little while, but of what is to follow or what went before, we know nothing at all. If, therefore, this new doctrine tells us something more certain, it seems justly to deserve to be followed.'" Now, the advisor's point is that as things stand, there is no certainty about what precedes or follows the present life. Under Anglo-Saxon paganism, it is only the here and now that is certain. Accordingly, any religion that sheds light on the history and future of the soul is an improvement on the status quo. From Bede's perspective, of course, Christianity offers such certainty in the form of doctrines concerning creation, salvation, and afterlife. And so the counselor's motivations are fully practical and rational. But it is the image used to express this position that is so striking. Its intent is for the brightness of the whole to represent certain knowledge, and for the dark of the world outside to represent uncertainty and ignorance. This is a common way of using light and dark. But Bede doesn't stop at this binary. In fact, he paints the scene in such detail that it ends up rather obstructing his purpose with it. What do you mean we don't know what the sparrow faces? By your own account, it will encounter a winter storm and an absence of all the things that make life in the whole pleasant. Judging by the vividness of the scene, it seems Bede has here permitted himself to venture into the realm of lyric, almost, a format we'll discuss in 2 weeks' time, and that is quite fond of descriptions of harsh winter weather out in a barren world devoid of human company. And so, in the midst of this comparatively dry work on the English church, we find here a tiny oasis of literary flourish that reminds us that even Bede did not live in a world devoid of literary quality. We'll face that world of lyric poetry head-on in 2 weeks' time. Next week, however, we move into the wondrous world of Anglo-Saxon manuscript culture in a guest lecture by manuscripts expert Dr. Christine Voth. Thank you very much.